Welcome to another episode of the Beyond Blocks podcast, a podcast about Drupal, PHP, open source, and related software development topics. I'm Oliver Davis. Today I'm joined by my guest, Mike Gifford. How are you, Mike?
Great, Oliver. Lovely to be on the podcast with you.
Yeah, we've been trying to organize this for a little while, so I'm glad we've been able to do it eventually, finally. And yeah, sometimes these things just take a little while to arrange when people have got busy schedules, so I
Absolutely.
appreciate you taking the time, and yeah, I'm sure we'll have a very interesting conversation between us and for the listeners to listen to as well.
I hope so.
Yeah, hopefully that's the idea. So for people who maybe don't know, can you share a bit about yourself and what you do?
Absolutely. So, Mike Gifford, I've been in the Drupal community for a long time. I used to be the owner of a company called Civic Action. A company called Open Concept. Sorry, I'm currently working for Civic Actions, but my company beforehand was Open Concept, and I started at that time being contributing to Drupal and Drupal's accessibility, and I became a core maintainer as part of that, and have been spearheading accessibility issues in Drupal since about 2009, and really learned a lot from that process of being engaged with the community and working in the open to try and make sure that Drupal 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 are as accessible as we can be, and was involved in the process where when Drupal became when Drupal took accessibility as a core gate, and tried to take accessibility more seriously, and that was great to be part of that. But in 2000 I joined Civic Actions, and so did the rest of my team. We started to work more with the U.S. federal government, so try to bring the expertise that we had delivered working with Drupal and with the government of Canada into supporting the U.S. federal government, and we've been doing that since then, engaging more in the U.S. and more internationally, and have joined the WC3 as an invited expert, trying to bring some a background around content management systems into the discussions, that's about it.
Yes, you mentioned Drupal 6. Yeah, I'm very fond of Drupal 6. I think that was the first version I came into around 2007, 2008.
Right.
So yeah, I have fond memories of Drupal 6 and things like CCK and all those sorts of other modules that yeah, I can't remember anymore. But yeah, fond time for me.
It's always funny that like what is the version number that you came in under, and how what are the memories you have trying to deal with that, and I think I came in at Drupal 4.5, partly because Omar Bickel had suggested that multilingualism was going to be brought into Drupal like any time now. And so the other content management system that I had built and maintained, called Backend, was I could just transfer my content over from Backend to Drupal and it'd have a much more stable interface. And it's like, well, we didn't quite get multilingual interfaces in Drupal until, well, probably really Drupal 8, really. So it was a long slog, but definitely have enjoyed being part of the community.
Yeah, it's an awesome community to get to be involved with. Yeah, I remember when I was at my first DrupalCon or Drupal camps, like everybody introduces themselves, put by their sort of handles on Drupal.org and
Right.
everything. Oh yeah, my name is this, but my handle is. But people know their user IDs as well most of the time. Like my user ID is 363 or whatever it is. Mine,
Right.
yeah, it's a badge of honor. Who's got the lowest user ID?
That's right. That's quite fun to go off and to see that. Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Now we've had usernames and user handles there for a while, which is one of my big changes actually when I was working for the DA was to introduce path auto on D.O for user IDs. But now
Right.
we digress.
Yes.
Cool. So yeah, we want to talk about accessibility, which is a keen topic or a topic that's sort of close to my heart, I guess, in a way. But yeah, what do we mean specifically by what is accessibility in this context?
So, I mean, ultimately, accessibility is about making sure that everyone can use a device or technology regardless of what abilities they might have. So how do we try and make sure that if you are without vision or have limited vision or limited hearing or limited mobility, that you're able to interact with the interface? And there's all kinds of ways that we have excluded people or given people bad advice or direction based on barriers that were just most people are unfamiliar with. An easy example is color blindness. Like the red green color blindness is quite common amongst men. I think it's about 5% of the male population has problems with red green color blind. But for the longest time, we were still sort of developing interfaces where red and green were used to indicate, stop or go, or yes or no, or pass or fail. And it's like, well, how do you, if color is still the only indicator that you're using, then you're excluding 5% of the male population, which is significant. Like that's not like if there's a, and you can't tell by walking down the street to see how many people are colorblind. And that's just sort of one instance. There's so many different kinds of disabilities, and I think that often we focus in on permanent disabilities. So, but we tend to overlook the temporary and situational disabilities, and we also think about disability as a constant, as opposed to like so many things in our life. They can, your abilities may change over time. Like when there's a allergy season, I'm less functional than I am at points when there's less pollen in the air. Like it's if I'm sneezing all the time and trying to go off and to deal with the challenges of just having my of pollen and my body's reaction to pollen, I may not be able to go off and to be able to focus as deeply because my brain is stuffed up with the effects of pollen. And so that's a sort of accessibility is a lot bigger than just dealing with people with disabilities. It's really about trying to see how do you make sure that the technology can meet people and the abilities that they have right now when they're trying to use the technology, and to build towards that reality.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact quote, but I remember reading or somebody saying that anybody can become temporarily disabled or whatever the phrase was. And I suffer from eye condition and have since I was young and sort of grew out of it as a teenager, but still flares up every so often where I literally can't open my eye for 3 days.
Right.
And I'm not suggesting that I'm able sort of to use a computer necessarily in that way. But I remember having to sort of feel my way around the house because I couldn't open my eye for that time. And that is something that would flare up every couple of months for a few days and then would go away. But yeah, like you said, it's not in the same way, I guess, thinking from a physical accessibility perspective. So if somebody falls and breaks a leg or something, then they're going to need to use a different, maybe they can't get up some stairs, or they have to use a ramp or a lift or something in as an alternative. Yeah,
One of
that's a
my
bit.
best friends has cerebral palsy, and I met him in my second year of university, and he actually my first year, but he introduced me to the phrase temporarily able-bodied. Like none of us know what abilities we will have tomorrow, and so we may we may be considered able-bodied today, but what about tomorrow? And even if you're completely able-bodied, you bring your smartphone outside and try and navigate directions with your smartphone on a sunny day. It's like, well, if you've got a light gray and a light background, or if there isn't sufficient contrast to view the font when you're outside, you're going to have a hard time being able to comprehend the information to use it, even if it's just to find an address where you're going to meet somebody.
Yeah, I'll come back to that sec, but I just want to just say something. Yeah, I've used words like disability and etc. already. You've used able-bodied. I'm hopefully not, going to say something that's offensive. Pick the wrong term for somebody. I'll try and be cautious of it. But if I do say the wrong term, that maybe it's, or the wrong incorrect term, hopefully nobody's offended by anything that if I say the wrong thing. But yeah, colour blindness is a definitely interesting one. Typically, the Welsh rugby team playing red, the Irish team playing green, and that was a problem for a long time. And there's been now they one of them has to play in a different color because it came up. So yeah, that was interesting.
That's totally funny. I hadn't heard of that one, but that definitely makes sense. But it is interesting though about in terms of language. Like, I think that ultimately people, most people, are will understand where you're coming from, and if you're coming from a good sp space and speaking, with from a perspective as an ally, even if you don't get the words right, most people will go and understand that. But there are also phrases like handicap. Generally, is a phrase that in English cultures we don't use to talk about disability, because of the associations tied to that. But in French, that is the appropriate word to use. And so if you're in a bilingual country, it's like, well, you're jumping back and forth between words that may offend some people because they have been used inappropriately for some times versus that is the official word to use. So I just think, we have to, as humans, be reasonable and realize that there's the intent matters.
Indeed. And, having worked in sort of the accessibility area a little bit, I worked for one agency that was very focused on accessibility and providing accessible websites. And from that, I built a website for a group called Accessible Bristol, where we just talked about Leonie off camera, voice on recording. That was a while ago. And yeah, everybody's what I've spoken to and has been, very, that's the word, is like accepting, understand, that maybe might not come up with the right term, like you say, the intent is key, I guess, especially in these sort of global communities, like you say, about it might be different in the UK versus the US versus Canada or something. Things do mean different things, and my favorite one is about tabling something. Like I would say, you want to table something to put it on the agenda, whereas most Americans would say you want to take it off the table. But yeah, particularly with global community like PHP or Drupal, I think it would make best intent to make things correct for everybody as much as we can, I'd like to think, in general.
And it's, ultimately it's about how do we make sure that we're removing barriers so that everyone can access the technology that is there, and how do we focus that so that we're able to find the best practices that meet the needs of most people, and build for the personalization that is now built into our devices. Like even something as simple as light mode and dark mode. I mean, every operating system and browser now supports that fully, but it's still not supported in most design systems or most websites. Most content management systems don't support light mode and dark mode preferences by default, even though there's clearly demand for it and clearly support for it.
Dark mode isn't just something developers do because it's cool. It's yeah, there is, yeah. Funny enough, yeah. Now you say that, I remember working with somebody who would use very high contrast. It was very everything was black and white and maybe purple, if I remember rightly. And there was yeah, just very minimal colors. And maybe it's the same. Somebody else would have everything would be blown up, very large font sizes or everything on their screens, so it was easier for them to see. So yeah, these things maybe are more common, but from a web perspective, it's not something I came across really until maybe sort of 3 or 4 years into my career when I went to join Dimenso, that agency I mentioned.
And
Yeah.
it's fascinating too. We don't there you know so much comes down to personal preference. There are people who require high contrast, absolutely, or even particular color combinations, like the use of forced colors to be able to say this is the easiest color contrast for me to be able to perceive information based on my eyes and how I perceive color and difference. But even just there are people who require low contrast. So apparently, if you're dyslexic, that having low contrast is useful. So giving people the choice to go off and say this is the type of contrast I want to have in order to perceive it is really quite useful. And I did really like the BBC had a tool called My Way ages ago, or a website where they explained how to go off and set up and configure your websites or your browser so that you could perceive the website in a way that worked the best for you. And I think AbilityNet now has that as My Computer, My Way, to do a similar kind of thing. But I think it's a really interesting way to go off and to think about how to educate users about the power and the capacity of the tools that are built into their operating system.
Yeah, that's mine. One of my laptops. It's a Windows 10, Windows 11. So, and the way it's been set up is every time I think it only does it from a cold restart, but will start reading out everything that's on my screen. It reads out my name. It reads out my department. All these things. It does it by default. But yeah, it's one of those things that is available in. I'm aware of. I guess Jaws is the one that's most familiar with from a screen reader perspective. Linux had Orca. I don't know if
And
that's even relevant
Chromebox
anymore.
did something similar as well with Chrome. Like if you could set up your Chrome device to do this. It was interesting that the GDS, the UK GDS Empathy Lab, which I've seen twice now, once before the pandemic and once after. But just having that sort of an infrastructure set up so you can test in different environments and that they work to create a virtual empathy lab as well, so that you could download an instance that would give you a sense of what this would how you could better understand how another user might be navigating your website. I think that's a really useful idea, but again, not one that has it's expensive to set up and maintain, and very few organizations invest in doing that properly.
Yeah, I remember we had one meeting room that was sort of done up almost like a living room. The people would come in and would do, I guess more, I don't necessarily accessibility, but usability testing, and we'd have them come in and say, right, now we want you to find where to buy a ticket or find something, and the camera would be tracking where they'd be looking and see how they would do it. And yeah, as a developer, like I see, it's obvious you click it there, but yeah, to get. To see how people who maybe not as familiar with it, or maybe we're making certain assumptions that they didn't actually make sense from a, I guess, from a usability perspective or from an accessibility thing. But yeah,
It's
slightly
worthwhile
different
also
ones.
mentioning that, like for that there's definitely some controversy around the use of empathy tools and approaches for empathy, like whether it's Mouseless Mondays or efforts to try and navigate, to turn off your screen and try and navigate with just a screen reader. I mean, I think those are interesting, useful tools to educate developers and designers about how their interfaces are structured, and to sort of just as an awareness tool. But so often, if it's not associated with actually having a relationship with somebody with a disability who's using that, so they can sort of can actually help inform people. I think that the challenge is often that the people tend to think that they understand how it is to have a disability if they've successfully navigated a few Mouseless Mondays, and it's like no, that's not exactly the same experience, and you need to be able to learn from people with lived experience who do this on a daily basis and have real experiences with this to see not just how like, yeah, and involving people with lived experience of disability and valuing their contributions in the process, I think is really key.
I completely agree. So, what does it mean for a website or an application to be accessible? If we've said what accessibility is, how do we know whether a site is accessible or not accessible?
Well, I think that the way that the European Union and the UK have basically approached this is by looking at a set of standards, the EN 301549 standards, which are a set of guidelines, and also incorporating an accessibility feedback form within that, so that people can give feedback to the developers to say what barriers they're running into. So you have once you've got both the hard-coded best practices of how to implement accessibility of standards and compliance towards a standard, and you have feedback for people with lived experience of disability, and so that's essentially what I see as a approach for developing an accessible website, where you're both complying with what are the codified best practices, and also trying to make sure that you're listening to your users, and engaging in a process of continual improvement. The other I also like to think like people do tend to confuse the WCAG compliance with accessibility, and I think that's it's sort of like the map is not the terrain, that concept, or c'est une pipe, this is not a pipe. There's paintings where you've got these, they're models that we create, and there's also the phrase that every model is wrong, but some are useful. This is very true with things like WCAG. These are models of and best practices and maps that help us understand a situation, but the real and you've got experts in accessibility or people who've worked on accessibility historically who have a lot of understanding about what are those best practices. Those are kind of like Sherpas. So you have the guidelines that are like a map. You've got the experts that are like Sherpas, and then you've got people who actually have disabilities who are trying to navigate your site, and those are your users. Like those are the people who may fall off a cliff and never be found again because they've given up on your service and found some alternative. So I think accessibility, the definition of that really is it's it should be more about how do we make sure that everyone can access the technology and that we have enough safeguards in place so that we're not losing people within a unmarked crevasse that leads them away from accomplishing their task.
That's an interesting answer. So I was thinking you say about standards, and like I'm aware of things like the WCAG standards, and they've got like 2.0, 2.1, 2.2, and there's I'm aware of like different levels. I know there's like everything from A to AAA, and they're usually the things I've had to target or to hit, and then and almost like now it's accessible tick.
Right.
But yeah, what you're saying is that obviously there's another layer to that or another level on top of that, on top of the
bringing in
standards.
the US, I mean the we'll see how this gets applied under the current administration, but historically, under the last administration, the advancements around the Section 508 and the there's an OMB memo that talked about accessibility and brought in some of the importance of accessibility. And they really talked about actually doing user research with people with disabilities and hard coding that into the process. So your definition of an accessible website for the US government was trying to A, make sure that it met the Section 508 compliance, which is essentially WCAG 2.0 AA. And that it also was something that addressed the usability needs by doing user research specifically with people with disabilities, and that's a different approach than how Europe has gone. But I think it's also there's a lot of validity in that approach. Like, how do we try and engage with groups to make sure that we're actually finding ways to bring people with disabilities into the process intentionally so that they're addressed. I love some organizations, they'll have a user research budget, but they'll allocate a certain percentage of that to make sure that they're covering that percentage, or that they're addressing the needs of people with disabilities within that. And there's a whole range of different disabilities. It's not just blind users. There's people who use voice control. There's people who have low vision. There's people who use keyboards. Like there's a lot of different types of people that you need to accommodate for. So there's a lot of different people to test for, but yeah, the standards are important because it's basically that consolidation of best practices. But it's not like the standards make somebody accessible. This is just one way to try and to codify best practices. And there's been some historical problems with that in the WCAG 1.0 and WCAG 2.0 sort of approaches to this. And there's an active process to build a WCAG 3.0. That there's still a lot of potential in, but it's definitely a controversial and time-consuming process to sort of revise how WCAG best practices are being codified.
I just feel as well, we probably should clarify when we're saying about WCAG, Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. Is that the right
That is
definition of
correct.
them?
Yes,
Yeah,
correct.
because I could imagine people listening to this going, what are they saying? What is this thing?
And it's also pronounced different ways. Like some people say WCAG or WCAG, or it's a terrible acronym. Like it's really a completely terrible acronym. But people do use it because that is the acronym.
That's what we need, is more acronyms.
That's right.
Yeah, I guess the other one, it's the W3C, which is I'm not sure actually what that one is off the top of my head, isn't it? But there's some overlap between those, if I remember correctly, or
The
am I misremembering?
No, the WC3 is a standards body, and the Web Accessibility Initiative is the accessibility arm of the WC3. The WC3 does a lot of different kinds of standards, whether that's HTML or CSS or RSS. Like they cover a lot of web standards, and accessibility is just one of those standards. And so it's a you're absolutely right that the and yeah, the web unfortunately does start with W. So for English at least, it's like you could there's different ways you could play with that, but if you want to include web as part of that, then that's a challenge.
Okie dokie. Just wondering which order to go in. Next, I've got a couple of other things I've got to write down. I'm thinking what the best ways of it, which is the best way this going to work. So you've mentioned things like HTML and CSS. How much, if I'm going to make things accessible, how much of that is coding versus how much of that is related to the content? And if we're working in a CMS type environment, how much, I assume, because it's a joint approach between the people doing the coding and the people putting the content in, but how much of there is a split between the two things? Is it primarily one over the other, or more responsibility of one over the other?
Oh, that's a complicated question, but let me see what I can do with this. I mean, I come at this from a CMS background, so I understand that the code itself has a huge impact on what is produced, and setting the good defaults like we've tried to do with Drupal will ultimately influence how accessible the content is. And I authored the Web Accessibility Almanac, the accessibility chapter last year. Sorry, it's a Web Almanac, the accessibility chapter for that. That was an interesting process to go through and to look at that. And Drupal is more accessible than most than many other content management systems, not more than all of them. There are definitely platforms that have a lot more control in terms of how the defines are, but you can definitely see how content management systems have a real world impact on the accessibility of sites. So that was useful to see. But I'm also part of the WC3's community group on the accessible roles and responsibilities mapping. So this is called ARM, and ARM is essentially structured to take all the digital roles that are involved in creating content and breaking this down to say what part of WCAG is the responsibility of a designer. What about a content person? What about, is this a governance issue? Is this something that a developer needs to take on, and to sort of pull this apart into responses, that there's a set of responsibilities that can that we can know, so we can say, okay, when you're hiring for a designer and they need to know about accessibility, here are the specific WCAG criteria that are that you should be looking for when you're hiring a UX person, or a visual designer like that, because there are some elements like color contrast should never be something that is decided by an engineer. Engineers probably don't have the best history of choosing which is the color contrast, the best color contrast ratios to be presented. All that information should be available, should be done by the visual designer before it ever gets anywhere past them. Like this sometimes, so you do want to start as early in the process as possible. There's a concept in accessibility called shift left, where the earlier you start the process of thinking about accessibility, the more impactful and the more robust and the more cost effective it'll be. So by investing in Drupal's accessibility, for instance, if you're investing in accessibility of the next version of Drupal, you're going to be saving as early as possible. Like that is the most cost effective way to go off and to invest in the accessibility of a content management system is while it's being developed. Like there's just no better time than to take the people who are developing those tools and get them to make sure that those tools are as accessible as possible, rather than waiting for after the project is already released in the wild and people are having to create all kinds of wacky hacks to try and address this issue. Like or just saying, oh well, we'll fix it in the next one. We'll fix it post-production. That's not a good approach. But in terms of the best approach, like it does really depend. Like I've heard estimates that so many of like as many of 90% of the accessibility issues start with design. But But I think that really depends on what perspective you happen to take on this, because I definitely think that there's a lot that the systems underneath our systems are, and the tooling is part of the problem as well. And that's not something that the WCAG guidelines address. Like, WCAG is very much focused on page by page assessments. Even in what I've heard with WCAG 3 and the discussions around WCAG 3, they're not considering the impact of the system, whether that's third-party JavaScript applications or content management systems or tools that you might be using with your Drupal install, like editorially. Like, none of that stuff is factored into the accessibility assessment. It's only like, what are the results when it's spit out onto a page that a user might interact with? But that it sort of blends together and merges all of these layers of technology that have an impact on what the end result is, and there's no real way to pull out the complexity. I've even heard of people being hired to do accessibility assessments, but being told they cannot look at the HTML, that they can only look at the results and the output from the assistive technology that they're testing with, and that the report has to be written exclusively from the results that are provided from that. And that's really problematic, because you probably don't have the budget to test for all the assistive technology out there, and that there are some instances where you can more quickly and easily see what the problems are by looking at the code, and or by looking at the document object model or the DOM, or looking at the accessibility tree, than it is by looking at the output from a assistive technology device. It's also like the ability to use automated tools, just it speeds up the process of testing so much more than if you build your testing process to only use manual testing to evaluate things.
Yeah, it's a couple of things there. I think you're right. It's definitely an end-to-end process that I think needs to start with design. And yeah, it's not something you can just fix by putting some sort of overlay or a toolbar or something on top and go, hey, now it's accessible,
No.
which I have seen. So yeah, I'm quite adamant that that's the case for me.
Yeah. I mean,
Yeah.
overlays are increasingly a problem, and it doesn't help that there are some sites like the Special Olympics uses an overlay, I think, last time I checked. The United Nations has accessibility pages that use an overlay. Like, there's enough big examples where they're using an overlay. Even some nonprofit organizations that specialize in accessibility use overlays. And partly it's because there's a compelling they can make a compelling argument, like, oh, look at this little bar. This allows you to have additional personalization. This is something that gives you the ability to say you care about accessibility, and it's only $50 a month, which is a lot less expensive than hiring a web developer to fix the 10,000 issues we can find on your website. So just pay us $50 a month, and we'll take care of all this stuff for you. But it doesn't work, right? And that's the challenge. The other thing is that I like to raise that all of these efforts of inserting a third party JavaScript application into your website provides both a security issue, because what's happening is that your entire web page is being, as soon as every time it's loaded, a user loads your web page, that interaction is being sent to a third party in some other country, likely being addressed, and magic is happening on the other side, and then it's being sent back before it loads into your user's screen. So it's a bad user experience, because they're having to reinterpret so much of and wait for the delays of your site being passed back and forth between different websites. The other challenge is that it's very bad for the environment to be having all this additional processing happening on the edge. So, as opposed to trying to fix the problems at source and make sure that they're being done right at as early as possible, it's like, no, we're going to fix the problem. Assuming we actually fix the problem, we're going to provide a fix for a problem every time the page is loaded, which is the very worst way to go off and address an issue from a technical perspective and from an accessibility perspective. And it's also just so fascinating that you can't reliably test your user experience when you're using an overlay, because your experience may be different when you test in your country or your environment than some the person who your user is. You can't emulate what your user is experiencing because they're probably going to be getting a unique experience through the JavaScript that's re-implementing the website for you. So
Yeah, that seems to be. I'm not sure what to say for you, especially in sort of the UK and I guess for me with in Europe as well. With every website with a cookie banner that now
right.
has to go on that you load a page and it comes up with some JavaScript powered cookie banner thing that you have to accept or reject and not. But yeah, they seem to typically be not accessible either. Like they don't do focus trapping very well or the everything. Yeah, they seem to be just so common now and most of them. Yeah, the same few we just use on all of them. Not sure which
Yeah,
one
no,
Drupal
it's
CMS uses, but yeah, maybe that's better. But yeah, the ones I've come across typically have not been very accessible.
yeah, it is fascinating things like the like so many problems probably should just be fixed in a different place. The cookie banners, like that is a real nuisance and it's cost I don't know how many million or billion euros have gone into sort of managing and organizing and setting up cookie banners for all of these websites, where if the European Union had simply said to browsers, you will not be collecting this information, people's privacy will be respected, and you will not have the and because even right now, like based on your the fonts and the screen resolution and so much information that the browser passes along to the server. Even if you say no cookies allowed, there is tracking because your browser is unique. There's so much stuff that can tie you down to an individual, whether beyond your IP address. Just the configuration of your settings is something that can be used to identify you for these large tracking services. So, fixing the problem in the right place is so critical, and I don't think the cookie banner was the right place to fix the problem.
Yeah, it's also scary to look at how many places they're going to send your data to if you do actually look at them rather than pressing accept all. Random thought. What about you mentioned about JavaScript? What about things like iframes? Like, I guess are they primarily I've seen mixed things about iframes and whether they're good or things for accessibility and if you put the right attributes on them, they're sort of better or not. But to me, that seems to be the same thing, right? You're sort of embedding somebody else's site into yours, which may or may not be accessible, but I can see that coming up with issues with DOM ordering or focus issues or something potentially as well.
It certainly makes things more complicated. I mean, certainly they're an old enough piece of internet technology that it's reasonably well supported, but and then having title text on the iframe is to describe it is definitely a very important. But I think that there are things like videos, so many people like the process of trying to host your own video on your own web server and have that efficiently delivered is a pain. And so, I mean, you can do that, but it's much easier to upload it to a service like YouTube or Vimeo or whatever and be able to then just embed it with a simple embed code that often, a piece of JavaScript that pulls in an iframe. Like it's a there there's a yeah I think that's a I think that's totally I mean it's I think it's there's challenges with testing and there's challenges with user interfaces but I'm not sure that they're I've not heard of places where it necessarily produces an accessibility barrier. I think that there are efforts within the WCAG 3.0 to try and say that if you embed something in an iframe that is not your that it is not your responsibility. The accessibility of a product embedded in an iframe is not the responsibility of the site owner. And I think that's challenging because then it just gives you the opportunity to offload the responsibility of accessibility to whatever third party you happen to use, as opposed to saying, we've chosen this third party and we're going to choose a third party because it's the most accessible. But it's a I think it is probably a lesser concern than all the JavaScript that people are using now, and or how badly the JavaScript is being implemented for users now. Like it's not like JavaScript is inherently an accessibility problem. It's just that it is an afterthought, and so many people who develop with JavaScript are not actually trained in the use of HTML. So they jump right to let's just use divs and spans for everything, and use area to create markup to provide semantics for those people who have disabilities. And that is the worst approach for accessibility. HTML is far better supported than area is, and it should be, people need to follow the first rule of area, which is don't use area.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, that's earlier on. So yeah, it would have been, which project was I working on? I can't even remember which version. Maybe Drupal 8, probably around that time. But yeah, we were looking at maybe 7. I can't remember. It's not that important anyway. But yeah, that's when I was first introduced to ARIA. Again, ARIA, which I don't know what that one stands for. But
And for a while there was is Way Area, or the Web Accessibility,
that's
sorry,
right. Yeah,
Web
WAIA.
Accessibility Initiative,
Initiative,
Accessible Rich Internet Applications. So,
yeah.
which is
More acronyms.
like yeah, is that did that really help anyone? Area is much easier to pronounce, but is also confusing for so many
Yeah.
reasons.
But I remember then having to use a lot more sort of roles. Like, I don't know, I think there was a navigation role. I think there was maybe a header role or a main role. But then I guess a lot of those seem to be superseded by HTML5 native elements, like actual main tags or whatever. So, but yeah, a lot of the issues I've seen generally, I'm just probably just thinking that the projects I've worked on have been where, yeah, some functionality has been added in some sort of JavaScript pop-up that should be like a list box or something. I don't know. And yeah, it's sort of, there's been roles added to it to try and make it work or make it correct, and yeah, it's actually made it worse, from what I can tell.
And Area can definitely do that because it changes, it overwrites the semantics of the HTML. So if you had a good a good HTML structure and you added bad area to it, you have made your site worse. And it's Area is also it's complicated enough that often what you think it's doing is not what it's doing. And so trying to go off and make sure that you're using the right application in the right place is, I don't have a good example for that right now, but I know that it's when I'm looking at an area implementations, I always try and look at the source and double check that this is indeed what it is doing, because there's certainly been times in the past where I've looked at area and is like, is that Yeah, that's not doing what I thought I was doing. This actually has another function. I need to look at the specs and figure out what is actually how what the best practice actually is of using this.
Yeah, there's definitely been times where I've looked at something and gone, it should just be a select list. Like, it doesn't need all this JavaScript, it doesn't need all these roles. There's an actual HTML element that I should be using. It's called select. You know, that's what it does, and it handles yeah, little flashbacks to something, but it didn't focus on the first item properly or whatever. It was like, it does that by default if you use the proper element that the HTML gives us. So yeah, I think I just stripped it out and replaced it with the native one. But you know, maybe there was a reason why it was done that way, but that was the way I fixed the problem, was by simplifying. But it worked in that case.
But it's interesting, like thinking about, how much information do you need to provide to somebody who's using assistive technology? What is the right level? And so this comes into something as simple as alt text for images, sort of the alternative text. So, do you should you have like a sentence? Should it be a paragraph? Should it be like NASA did one of some images from Hubble, where they went and basically had a full paragraph describing the image that was available, and it got them a lot of good publicity because it was really quite interesting to go off and to hear all of the description of the what was being presented in the photo, but it was also. That's probably more than you'd want to have on every image on a website. That is not a good example for what every image should have. But there's a balance, and so much of that comes down to like getting feedback from your users about what is the right level of information that they need, and trying to manage that. And that's something that we've tried to do within the Drupal community, particularly around patterns that have not been well, they're not well known. So not all patterns are as documented and tested and evaluated, particularly in complicated authoring interfaces like Drupal has. If you have a complicated authoring interface with lots of different dynamic components, that's not something that you can go to a blog post from anyone like Adrian Roselli or Scott O'Hara or others who really have written some amazing work, and you can't point to their work and say, okay, they've tested this, because no, there's no, this has not been tested. This is a new pattern that we are running that is being implemented here, and hopefully we'll establish a best practice, but we can't draw on somebody else's.
Yeah, you mentioned alt tags. So yeah, I was just thinking now, what are your feelings using things like AI to generate things like alt text on images? Because I've seen that being used even maybe in Drupal CMS or at least in some sort of demo. But I've definitely seen like, yeah, some people upload an image and have, you know, ChatGPT or something providing some alt text for it. Like,
I
do you have
used to be
any
ver
thoughts on
I have lots, I have lots. I used to
that?
be very opposed to this, because I didn't think that it's not just about the description of the image, but it's also about the context with which the image be is being placed, and that you really need to have an understanding of not just what that image is, like you've got Gandalf the cat behind you, which
Yeah,
people in the
I do.
podcast will not be able to hear, but it's most of our conversation, that if we took a picture right now of us talking, the picture of Gandalf the cat wouldn't be relevant unless we happen to talk about paintings that are in the background of our conversation. Same with the bear that's behind me in my image. Like, yes, there's a little bear that was drawn by a cousin, or painted by a cousin of mine. That isn't something that would come up in alt text unless it is relevant to the content of the discussion. But I for FOSDEM, I decided I would use AI to go off and to write a script. I think it's a Python script that would crawl a website using Beautiful Soup and would provide all of the images that are on that website, and the alt text, the title text, the area elements that are associated with that image, and to have all of that available in a CSV file, so I could look at the results and be able to say, okay, looking just at the alt text that's available there, do I have any idea of what this image is or why it was there? And I was just so, after looking at perhaps 100 different government websites that all have the requirements that should have alt text, and alt text being the simplest of things, I realized, like, humans are just bad at alt text. We don't prioritize it. Like, there's a few sites that I ran into that are good. Like, the City of Ottawa has good alt text for the most part. Not entirely, but for the most part, they have really quite substantial and meaningful alt text. But the government of Canada does not. Neither does the many European Union websites. Like, it's the UK doesn't have a lot of images, so alt text isn't really a big deal. But a lot of government websites use images as ways to draw in their users and to have more user engagement. But yeah, I do think that the approach that Drupal CMS has taken is the right approach. So if you set up Drupal CMS, which I encourage everyone to do if you haven't already, and the launcher is really quite a great way to go off and to get started with this. You can just have it. You don't have to set up a unique development environment. You can actually just download an app and have it run on your system, whether it's a Linux and Mac or Windows device system. You can run a, I think that's right, I think on Linux. It certainly runs on Windows and Mac. It's no use for you on your Chromebook, but it's if you're not using a Chromebook, you can run it fine. Run Drupal and set up an AI provider, and then enable the AI alt text module. And what happens is that you're given the option to you upload the image, you're provided alt text as an editor to review, and then as the editor, you can look at it and evaluate that, and then you can hit submit. And just like even for myself, like I don't write as detailed alt text for images that I upload as I would get from alt text, because I try and think about like, well, what is really the critical element here? What do I want to try and provide? But I'm also, short of time like everyone else. So I just put in something that is getting the gist of what's available. But I would never go and describe that I was wearing a gray shirt and you were wearing headphones, for instance. But that's something, or that we're both wearing glasses. Like again, that's not something I would have bothered to include in a screenshot of our image. But AI will probably provide that information, and it's not bad information to include. It may be too much, but again, you can confine the limit to how much you want to have responses back. Like, do you want it to be 250 characters? Do you want it to come back to you as a haiku? Do you want it to be a professional format, professionally formatted? Is it a friendly tone, a funny tone? Like, you can put information into that alt text to make it more consistent and more reliable and more meaningful than what we can do for people today.
Yeah, I'm maybe getting it wrong, but I think I've seen Jamie give a talk at the recent DrupalCamp in England, or maybe it was DrupalCon. But coming away from that and seeing about, or maybe it's even in Dries's note, but about always having a human in the loop.
Yeah,
So I think
that's
having
critical.
AI to give you like what it thinks the alt text could be, but then not just saying yes, that is the alt text, that you as the human can then go in and say yes or accept, or I want to change it, or maybe it's completely wrong. But yeah, having that opportunity to sort of change or override it, I think is critical.
I mean, being using the old Ronald Reagan quote, "Trust but verify," because that does really summarize things. Like you can ask these questions. You should go off and often that the information is good enough to be trustworthy, but you have to verify it. And that act of verifying it is on you. If you publish this information and AI gives you crap and you have not verified it, then that's on you, right?
Yeah, I think that's, yeah, sums up my whole thoughts with AI. I think maybe in general. Yeah, the amount of time I've asked it something and it's given me some code and I've tried it and it's just gone, hey, that function doesn't exist.
Right.
And I'm like,
Yeah.
yeah, you're just making stuff up at this point.
But it's fascinating the places where it does work and it can work really well. And there's other places where it's like, and sometimes it just like it gets onto a train where it's like, just admit you're wrong and give me like just fess up to the fact that you have no idea what you're talking about and don't make shit up. Like, I don't it's it's a sorry.
It sounds so confident sometimes, or it'll give me something and I'll try it and it gives me something else and I'll say, no, that doesn't work. And it gives me the first suggestion again. I'm like, it didn't work
Right.
the first time. But yeah, it's understanding its sort of role and place, and yeah, everyone's got their
And
own opinions on that as well.
it's also important when we're talking about AI to also highlight that there are huge environmental impacts with AI and the drive to go off to use AI for everything in bigger and bigger models and more places. And I think that we need to be conscious about how we're using that technology as well, and not to use it frivolously by adding haikus to all kinds of things that don't need haikus. But it's a so there's that aspect. I'm also I didn't mention before, but I'm part of the web sustainability the WCAG also, sorry, the WC3 also has a web sustainability group that I'm part of. And part of this is trying to say, like, we have to look at the environmental impact of the web. All of our technology has an environmental impact, and we have to take responsibility for that to make sure that we're de delivering more performant, more responsible websites, and see that we're improving that, day after day, just like we try and do on accessibility.
Yeah, that's a very good and important point. I've seen people give talks about green websites and everything, and yeah, think about the environmental impact of the websites as well. But like you said, if you're adding in all this JavaScript and everything, it's obviously just adding to the size of your, or the amount of time it's gonna have to, or the amount of processing it's gonna need to serve that. So yeah, I think it's less is more, I think, is usually
Yeah,
my thinking on it.
absolutely. And I mean, that comes down to security as well. Like, security, accessibility, like if you can simplify and take time to make sure you're delivering what's the most important to your users, they're going to be happier because the page is loaded faster and more reliably. There's less stuff to go wrong. I like the analysis that the average web page today is bigger than the initial download of the video game Doom. So you've got a a multi-party shooter game that was popular in the 90s, and
Probably, yeah.
like full color graphics and interactivity and stuff, and yet that game was more compressed and smaller than a web page that just happens to have lots of CSS and lots of JavaScript and lots of huge images that aren't needed but are easy to do. So people are just adding them because it's easier to add them than not.
Yeah, indeed. It's when people start comparing technology to the amount of technology that's needed to land on the moon or something. Do you
Right.
think, yeah, scary.
Or
I've
just
seen stuff have changed.
like most satellites in orbit today are far less sophisticated than what we have in our phones, or sorry, in our pockets. Like the technology
Yeah.
is not like
Or a smartwatch.
if you launch something into space, you expect it's going to have to be resilient and last for a long time. If you're going to expect somebody to buy a new one every 2 years, like, yeah, why bother with resiliency? Like,
Yeah, indeed. So we've talked about accessibility. We talked a bit about Drupal. So if we bring those two things together, and yeah, so do you think if you're trying to build an accessible site, like is Drupal or Drupal CMS a good choice if you're trying to build something that's accessible?
I'm very, very biased, but I think it still is the best choice. There are some interesting initiatives that are happening in other content management systems that I do like to point out as well. But I still think that Drupal is the best choice. Wagtail has incorporated an accessibility checker into to core, as has Joomla, so that there's for editors get support for I think with Wagtail it's built in to the build process, so that when you're building the website it'll report when there's errors. I haven't actually set it up, so I'm not sure, but it as I recall was not just tied to the editor interface. But Joomla is incorporating I think it's Sally into the which is very much like editorially, but it's designed by a different guy in a different university, but the same, they editorially and Sally are two different similar tools that are both being developed in open source and have slightly different needs and communities, but they collaborate and c compete quite nicely together. But yeah, having Sally built into Joomla is a big step ahead. There's a lot of people who've done some interesting work on WordPress. I'm definitely looking forward to the accessibility documentation that Rian Reisfeld is writing. She was involved in the WordPress accessibility team, and there's so much to having good documentation for how you should implement accessibility. And I know that we don't have that in Drupal. There's a lot of improvements that can be made in explaining to developers how to build an accessible website, how to use the modules, how to configure it properly. Even things like if you're building a multilingual sorry, even if you're not building a multilingual website, there should be the option there it should I think it should be enabled by default, but the but it's a configuration you need to enable within CK Editor to have a drop down for language of parts. So right now you need to be able to enable the language of parts. You need to enable it in CK Editor. So if you use a phrase like je ne sais pas in a sentence in English, you should be able to specify that to say this is actually a French phrase,
Okay.
so that the assistive technology knows that it's a French phrase in an English sentence. That's not a good example, but that like th this happens all the time where you have websites that have a snippet of text in another language and do not put in the information, the semantics to say this is no longer in the default language of the website.
Yeah, I've think of it, we've got a custom language switcher on one project that I work on. So yeah, on the English side, it's got the word Cymraeg, which is Welsh, and then
Right.
obviously in Welsh, it's got English. So yeah, that's got a little tag on it that says that part is in Welsh and then that part's in English.
Yeah,
So.
and that's not hard to do, but you have to think about it. And if you've got content that is referring to the Welsh content in English that's referring to the Welsh document, maybe it's only available in Welsh. Maybe it was an event that took place in Welsh. Well, you should have that information. The link that has the title in Welsh should be included as should have a span or should have a what is it? This is lang equals what is Welsh for the language code?
CY, I think, for Cymraeg.
Right, that makes sense. I keep wanting to start with the W, but it yeah.
it would. Yeah, I'm actually just thinking, yeah, what doing that, does it, it's been a while since I checked, but would it actually cause like screen readers to read out differently rather than trying to read it out? I guess it must.
I mean, the
I have to
screen
try it
readers
again.
are like in some of them, like JAWS may go off and recognize that that this text is in Welsh. It's like there's too many consonants here. It doesn't make any sense in English. I will not try and pronounce this in English. And it may be smart enough to go off and to translate this into into to recognize that the language is Welsh and speak in Welsh. But I think most other screen readers probably are not that sophisticated. And still, I just listened to how badly Google Street Map mangles French words in Canada. Like you're trying to navigate around, but in a bilingual city, and it still doesn't realize that rue and street are the same thing, and you don't need to pronounce them twice. Like some of the stuff is not rocket science, and yet a little company like Google can't seem to figure it out.
Yeah, you mentioned the Sally project. I was watching a talk about the local Gov Drupal, which is a distribution that's been built for local governments in the UK and Ireland. So the one I live is my local authority is running it, and I don't know if it's quite the most popular now, but it's definitely getting up there in terms of usages across UK councils. And yeah, that's I think got Sally built into it now as an option by default, which seemed really interesting because they had options to pick colors of the UI, and I thought, oh, if you do that, people are going to pick colors inherently not accessible. But yeah, yes, this having the, so puts, ironically, based on what we were just saying, a little JavaScript pop up in the corner and runs things. But yeah, it gives some point of reference to the people. Like you said, I think it's primarily content editing. But yeah, this code not accessible or whatever.
Yeah, it's Adam Chabrok is the guy behind Sally, and he's created an interesting color picker tool that's built into Sally that replaces some other ones that weren't available. But I really do actually quite like the local gov Drupal. It's a really wonderful example of how both companies and municipalities can cooperate together to build something that is much bigger than the sum of its parts. They've created there's a module that they're building and looking for more funding on, but there's a module to take PDFs and convert those PDFs to HTML. And
Oh, yeah, sorry.
I do quite dislike PDFs because although they're incredibly convenient, they're really hard to make accessible and they really suck for mobile users. So if you're trying to convey to most users these days, like the primary device is probably a mobile phone. So trying to go off and build to that audience means you should never be producing PDFs unless you want a print-friendly version. Like it might be an alternative, an acceptable alternative to HTML, but it should never be the primary document like it is in so many contexts. But they're able to innovate and be able to do stuff, and they're really a wonderful example for what municipalities and governments in general should be doing to try and collaborate together to build more effective citizen services that really meet an international need, not just the need of one country or one group of cities.
Yeah, I've definitely come across that with, hey, we've got all these PDFs, we need to make them into HTML. But yeah, I find that interesting given as PDF itself is like a standard, and I've I use I write my markdown my presentation slides in restructured text and use something called RST to PDF to export them as PDF, and that's
Right.
what I present from, but also what I upload onto my site for people to read. So yeah, it's I again read mixed things about you can have some that are accessible and some that aren't, but it also seems like the other options you've got are big JavaScript heavy things that do presentations and notes and things. It seems like the simplest option, but maybe not
But there's
the most
probably an
ideal one.
option for restructured text HTML, right? Like that would be an easy conversion.
Probably,
And
yeah.
even if you're starting from a presentation that is that even if you're presenting from a PDF view, and there's nothing wrong with presenting from a PDF view. The PDF might be more accessible than a Google Docs or PowerPoint presentation, but if you can provide an HTML version of that with a simple, conversion tool like that would be, having both available would be quite useful from that perspective. And I mean the biggest problem with PDFs is that they're just so easy to produce and there's so many of them and yet they're so hard to make accessible by default. There's a tool that the government of Luxembourg created. What is it? Simple PDF. It's a where sorry it's not on GitHub sorry as I type while I'm doing this the Simple Alley PDF crawler and it where I'll just put this in the chat here which is not useful for those of us on the call but it basically goes through and will crawl your domain. Pull out down all of the PDFs on the domain and store them locally, and then run a crawler on that to determine what are some of the common accessibility errors for those PDFs, and gives you a CSV of the accessibility errors of the PDFs,
Oh, cool.
so it's a really powerful tool that this that the government of Luxembourg has produced that should be really more widely implemented. But still, it's if you even if you have an accessible PDF for somebody who uses a screen reader, that's not going to help you if you are using it on your mobile trying to access it on your mobile phone. Like it still doesn't rescale for your mobile phone. So.
Yeah. No, I'll put a link to that in the show notes so people can look at it. Now I'm thinking I should just upload the restructured text. People can read that as an option. But yeah, I digress.
I would refrain from doing that, although I guess just because I don't know, like,
No, there we go. Yeah, I wasn't seriously suggesting I do that.
but it was funny. It's funny.
So you said either before we started recording or just afterwards about accessibility testing gates in Drupal core, and so I'm curious to learn about that, but and then how Drupal core, Drupal CMS, how does it, we mentioned automation a few times as well, like how does that whole thing work, and how does Drupal itself make sure it's accessible, and how does it verify that with contributions from obviously from various different people? Is
It
that something
is
you can speak
a
to?
it's a work in progress, but I think it was in Drupal 7 that no, it was maybe it was Drupal 8 the gate process was implemented, and there were four gates established: the security, performance, something else, and accessibility. Maybe it was
Automated testing.
design, might have been UX.
That's, one
Actually, no,
did
the
come in
fourth.
for automated testing, but maybe that was later.
It might have been later, but so there was these gates that basically allowed a few different elements to stop a release and to say we're not going to release Drupal until we address this issue. And in Drupal 7, the initial there were some barriers that are in accessibility that caused Drupal 7 to be delayed for a couple months based on accessibility issues in the Drupal backend. Likewise, there were some challenges with Drupal 8 where we were there, so additional delays that happened because of accessibility issues there. There haven't been as many for the more recent releases, but there certainly is a precedent for going off and saying we cannot ship this until it passes this gate, and this gate requires these elements. There is testing built in for Core at the moment. There was an effort to bring in Nightwatch into automated testing. I think that that's being swapped out from Nightwatch to Cypress. I'm not positive about that,
Okay.
but there was Nightwatch was not as popular and was a little bit harder for people to get their heads around, and there was never really the ability to expand the Nightwatch beyond Core. So you couldn't go off and take the Nightwatch tests and incorporate the other elements, but like other modules, you could automatically test other modules easily with Nightwatch, how it was configured within Drupal core historically, and with tied with the Drupal administration. I was really happy that my colleague Daniel Mundra was able to work with people like I don't know, Ben, why am I forgetting Ben's name? Ben Mullins of Acquia, to try and come up with a Nightwatch Axe integration that made it easier for us to do that testing. But I think we're at the process now where a lot of that's needing to be rethought because of the testing infrastructure and the within Drupal core. But the basic idea is with every commit of or every pull request of for Drupal core and Drupal modules, we should be able to run it against a set number of pages to say what are the accessibility issues that are built into that may result because of this. Are we seeing more or less accessibility issues when we run an accessibility test like Axe against our CI/CD pipeline? And if we incorporate that on a regular basis and catch accessibility issues before they get into core, then it is much more efficient and much more effective because there's more basically more automated eyes catching for automated bugs rather than having something get into core and then having the accessibility team realize that there's a barrier in the problem or in the code and then having to revert the issue or whatnot.
Yeah, it's when I've ever given talks and made my course about testing. Usually I'm talking about functional testing or integration tests or unit tests. I typically haven't looked at Nightwatch or Cypress testing from that side. But I guess in that situation, I can make a submit a patch to core and know that a test is now broken and therefore it won't get committed until it gets fixed.
Yes,
So is
that's
this
how
what
it
you've
should work. I don't
Yeah.
know that that's
Whereas,
technically how it works today, but that is how it should
yeah, I
work.
guess that's the ideal thing. So, are
Yes.
you saying that for each merge request is also going to run a series of accessibility checks and then also potentially stop that individual merge request being merged? Or does it just provide you with metrics over time that you can look back on and say, hey, the number of things has gone up over the last 3 months or something?
The plan was to provide merge specific feedback so that there was a and it wasn't necessarily like I would love it. All these tests are built with DQ's Axe or possibly with Google Lighthouse, which includes DQ's Axe as the accessibility testing tool for that.
Okay, I didn't know that.
I would love it if every commit was tested to make sure that it was both performant, that there were you weren't adding a performance load by contributing this patch, and that it was the no new accessibility issues were being added. Like that's sort of a bare minimum, but I mean ideally you'd be able to say that Drupal core meets an Axe zero standard. Like there's no Axe errors that are detected in every commit of Drupal core, so that you're committed to a nice easy number of zero as opposed to less or more. You're just trying to deal with there's none, we're good. But we haven't gotten to that level yet.
Yeah, it's almost like code coverage, I guess, isn't it? It's sort of 70% covered, or and that number is it's a sliding scale that it will change depending on how much code there is. The
Yeah.
percentage may go up or down, but
And it keeps like we keep changing the code because it's there's new features that are required. There's new demands. We realize that some elements are not required and are being taken out of core, even if they had complete core test coverage. It's like, well, we no longer need that. So that's a contrib module now.
I think one of the interesting things I've seen, except at older things in Drupal 7, where things were a lot more set in stone. But I think as a community, like you say, moving, if we decided that Nightwatch wasn't the best option or there was a better option, then we could move to something like Cypress.
Right.
I like that we do that as a community. We're always looking to evolve and iterate. And I've seen core issues about evaluating HTMX rather than Ajax. And
Right.
yeah, even though with, a 20-year-old CMS, like we're still trying these sort of new things. And I think really embracing AI and all this, these other things whilst, getting a good foundation, things like security,
Yeah.
accessibility, like all this, like we do have a good coverage of all these things, and UX as well, which I think is, yeah, it's all awesome.
It is a really amazing platform for ambitious projects, like and especially with AI. Like I think that that's what Jamie and the others in the accessibility team have done to incorporate AI in all kinds of like fascinating ways. Like I've barely scratched the surface about what the AI team is doing
Me
with
too.
AI, but it's fascinating. It's like this is just like a whole engine of innovation that has exploded, and having a solid core infrastructure allows that to happen and allows you to trust in the infrastructure that's there, so that you're not having to recreate the wheel. Like just have the was the MCP servers, like being able to use Drupal as a central storage and organizing server for other AI and agentic sort of agents. Like that's like wow, like I barely understand that, and yet like there's people who are able to pull this together and use this the structure effectively to do much more ambitious things leveraging AI.
You mentioned a few things earlier on about documentation, that potentially there was some need for some documentation about how to build more accessible sites in different modules or everything. If people want to contribute and they're looking to contribute back to things, is there a particular, like, is there a needs accessibility tag or anything in the queue? Are there working group meetings? Is there a documentation initiative that people can contribute to? Where would be the a good place for people to start if they were looking to help improve those sorts of things or
That's a
accessibility
good
in general?
question. I mean, most people are directed to the website from the, I mean, if you're looking at accessibility, the footer of every Drupal.org web page has a link to our page that touches on accessibility. And part of the challenge of this is if this is the landing pad that people are going to access, how do we get people from this into our community so that they're contributing and engaging with us? How do we try and make sure that these all of the resources that are linked to from this page are that it's not just a wall of links? I'm very good at producing walls of links, but actually producing something that allows people to know where to jump in, that provides the right sort of tone and cultural association so that people know that this is really a core value of our community and that we need their involvement, that we're not all experts that know all the things. We do want to have feedback from others is important, and we need to have more contributors. So trying to get people to look at our existing documentation and starting from this accessibility page would be a good start. I think we can. There's a lot of effort to in Drupal in general with our documentation. Like so much of it is being written around Drupal 7, but some of it even goes back further than that. And I think we just
Oh,
need
yeah.
to we need to archive a lot of that old stuff. And how do we try and take some of the good information that's still probably relevant to Drupal 7, but just sort of get somebody to look over it and say, okay, we need to update this for Drupal 8, which means X, Y, and Z. I'll draft something in a Google Doc. I'll share with a few people, make sure that it makes sense. And then once we've got this confirmed by people who know what's happening with the later versions of Drupal, we're going to archive this page, and it will not be found. It will not be searchable on Drupal.org. Well, maybe it'll be in some, we'll have some way to deal with this, which is not going to be as search engine friendly, and it'll help us make sure we're promoting relevant information that's relevant to the versions of Drupal that are being used today. So there's lots of that stuff that needs to happen. But joining the Drupal Slack is probably also quite useful. So there's a lot of people who are there, and you can get announcements for upcoming meetings. There's also meetings that are happening around Drupal CMS. So if you're interested in any of that, the work around Drupal CMS, which is distinct from Drupal Core or Drupal, the content management system, there's a group that's looking at Drupal CMS that which touches on a lot of other modules as well, because not everything in Drupal CMS is part of Core. Although some pieces that are part of Drupal CMS are now being brought into Core. So the Jin admin theme, for example, is being brought into Core.
Yeah, so it's becoming the default. I think it's 11.3, I think it's becoming the default admin theme, which, yeah, I think again it's good that we can just keep evolving and iterating on these things.
Yes, but
Yeah,
there
it's
are
awesome.
accessibility issues with that module that need to be addressed, particularly with color contrast, because it's something that
Jin,
has
yeah.
Jin has lots of interesting options for customizing your theme, but A, we're not starting with good defaults. Like all of the defaults that are provided in like ideally, all the defaults that are provided in Core are going to be tested for accessibility. So if you choose any of the defaults, you're going to get a reasonably accessible website. But that's not the case with Jin. You're going to be able to pick and choose color combinations that some administrator who doesn't know anything about color contrast or people's vision or accessibility will be able to pick wacky contrast that they like because they have the authority and nobody else does. But hey, pink and purple are great colors, so we'll make them our like
Yeah.
this is not the kind of choices that we want to give our systems administrators or they should not be making these kinds of decisions, but it's that's where we're at right now anyways.
Yeah, it's a great theme. I think it looks awesome. But yeah, I guess it's one of those things, like, yeah, it's not, quote, just adding something into core. There's all these, things to think about, especially with themes of accessibility and
Right.
just ma from maintenance perspective as well. Yeah, no, it's yeah, I guess those things, if it's in core, they'll be addressed as part of the core issue queue, whereas I guess at the moment it's still its own project with its own
That's
issues,
right.
maybe.
That's
Okay.
right. So and I think that the ability to, as a contrib project for a maintainer to say, this is not an accessibility issue. This is a nice to have or to push it off. I mean that's an option if you're maintaining a theme or a module that's not part of core. But if it's a part of core, it is supposed to meet this. We've as a community agreed to meet WCAG standards, and in fact to meet WCAG 2.2 standards, which are the which is what any modern web system should be trying to achieve, because that's the latest recommendation for the best user experience for people.
Indeed. Yeah, I feel like we could keep talking for another couple of hours, I think,
You
if
definitely
we
could.
could. No, it's just been a great, yeah, interesting, funny conversation. It's been awesome.
Yes.
Where can people find you online, right, if they want to get in touch and find out more?
So the best way to go off and to find about me and where I'm at is in my nice little I have a really short domain name, which is ox.ca, and all my socials are up there. So, I got this domain through a friend who registered it a long time ago, and but it's quite funny to have a super short domain name.
Yeah, it's almost like a short URL style,
That's
short
right.
domain. Yeah, I think that's cool. Awesome. Thanks for joining me today. Thanks for taking the time. Yeah, really glad we could find a chance for us to chat. It's been awesome.
Yes, the same here.
And thanks everybody for listening to the Beyond Blocks podcast. I'm Oliver Davis.